This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello there and welcome to Inside Europe. In Bonn, I'm Rob Turner. In today's programme, German lawmakers approve an extended EU rescue fund despite bailout blues in the country. Also on the show, why the next generation of European leaders are pessimistic about the future, how the Czech Republic is bucking Europe's anti-nuclear trend, and the Turkish doctors curing intensive care patients with music.
We just take a picture from the monitor. Pressure is 170. Pulse rate is 120. In 15 minutes, giving Sufi music, the pressure comes down to 125 with the same medication, without changing any medication. And the pulse rate comes down, and a patient feels more relaxed.
Stay tuned for those stories and more. The German Parliament this week approved plans to increase the country's contribution to the Eurozone bailout fund to €211 billion. Earlier in the week, the lender and the borrower came together in Berlin. German Chancellor Angela Merkel met her Greek counterpart, George Papandreou. He was in Berlin to reassure his country's creditors that Greece is on course to cut its deficit and that it's not wasting German taxpayers' cash. His plea for more money seems to have been heard, but as Stephen Beard now reports from Berlin, the Germans are showing clear signs of bailout fatigue.
Florian Hessler sells food here on Alexanderplatz. Like all street vendors in Germany, he must be licensed. He pays his taxes, and he's appalled by the growing disorder in the Eurozone and that Germany has to pick up much of the tab for it.
Warum?
Why should we always give our tax money to other countries? If they run up debts, they should pay them themselves.
Florian is not happy that once again Greece has asked its European partners for yet more cash.
Der deutsche Anteil beträgt 28%.
This was the German leader Angela Merkel last year asking the Parliament or Bundestag for €22 billion to lend to the Greeks. Then the Irish got into trouble. Then it was the Portuguese. And now it's the Greeks again that need help. In all, Merkel has pledged €200 billion in loan guarantees. Matthias Warnecker campaigns on behalf of German taxpayers. He's not impressed with Merkel's financial manoeuvrings.
It means using the old recipe, raising new debt to fight old debt. And that might buy us some time, but that won't solve the problems.
Some say Mrs. Merkel is part of the problem for failing to take definitive action. Moritz Schulerich is a professor of economic history.
It's part of her personality to be cautious, to avoid grand schemes, grand solutions, avoid being bold. She's sort of a one step at a time person.
Another German economist says the crisis urgently needs a grand, bold move because now the hedge funds and other speculators are betting that the third biggest economy in the Eurozone, Italy, might default. Ferdinand Fitchner is with the DIW think tank. He says the Eurozone must fight back with overwhelming firepower.
Increasing the bailout fund would be an important signal that it simply doesn't make sense to speculate against euro area countries. If the rescue fund is big enough, it's quite clear that it's just not worth it.
How big does it have to be, though?
Maybe five times as big as it is right now.
That would be the equivalent of €2 trillion. Reports emanating from off-the-record briefings in Washington now suggest there is a plan to expand the bailout fund to this level. The fund would borrow the extra cash, with Germany guaranteeing more than a quarter of it. Henrik Enderlein of the Hertie School of Governance says this won't be easy. Germany just cannot trust some of its European partners.
Greece lied on its fiscal and budgetary position in order to get into the euro area. So there is concern in Germany of people saying they've cheated once, they will cheat again.
The fear is that under the shelter of Germany's economic might, the Greeks and other less prudent eurozone members will embark on another spending spree, and that will drag down Germany's credit rating. Hans-Olaf Henkel is a former head of Germany's main business organisation. He wants an immediate end to all the bailouts for the sake of German democracy.
8
80% of the German public are fed up with those policies of continuing helping Greece, Portugal, and in the future, probably Spain, Italy, and finally even France.
No wonder Angela Merkel has dithered, says Henrik Enderlein. The German leader is being squeezed between two conflicting issues.
On the one hand, there is a strong reluctance in the German public to give money to Greece and to other countries in difficulties in the euro area. On the other hand, she knows that she has to keep the euro together and the euro area functioning, otherwise there would be huge costs for Germany.
Wir sind gegen den Euro und gegen die Europäische Union.
The message at this rally in Berlin could not have been clearer. We are against the euro. The euro is a threat to Europe. But that was the message from the man with the megaphone. The response from the audience was telling. There were only about a dozen protesters there. The Germans are torn. They hate the bailouts, but they still cling to the euro for fear of what might happen if it were to collapse. Stephen Beard, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
And of course, it's not just Germany looking for a solution to the Eurozone crisis. EU officials are constantly cranking out proposals to try and deal with the problem, such as a financial transaction tax or Eurobonds. Many of those officials are graduates from the College of Europe, which lies some 200 kilometres northwest of Brussels. It was created to promote a European identity and a spirit among its students. And famous alumni include British Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg and the new Danish Prime Minister. But as Vanessa Mock found out, the class of 2011 is less than confident about Europe's future.
Horse-drawn carriages carrying tourists in the picturesque town of Bruges, home to the College of Europe, the elite finishing school for future Eurocrats and European leaders. All the students here are betting on a future within the European Union.
I'm Angela O'Neill, I'm Director of Communications and Languages here. I've been working here for about 11 years, so I've known 11 years of very successful alumni coming through our doors.
OK, well, I'd love a little tour, actually. Absolutely. So we're starting here, obviously, with the obligatory array of flags.
Absolutely. I mean, you're arriving at the College of Europe, so you've got the European flag, you've got the Belgian flag, the college flag, and, of course, it's the Polish presidency at the moment, so just like at the European Commission, we are also showing the Polish flag.
As we walk along, Angela explains that students have been coming for 60 years to this college that was founded, among others, by Winston Churchill after the Second World War.
Just down here, you are going to see our wonderful display of photographs, which we're very, very proud of all the very famous European leaders who have been to the College of Europe to make keynote speeches about Europe. Also, Margaret Thatcher was amongst one of our guests, François Mitterrand, Jacques Delors, you name it, they've all been here.
As Europe traverses this very stormy time, do you feel that this is somehow filtering into the college, what's happening right now? Is it something that you're trying to address with the students?
Oh, absolutely. And yes, at the moment, they're very worried about the economic crisis. They're worried about their own futures.
So you have these two complete political opposites.
I've been speaking now to some of the students, and I found out that they're pretty much here for the same two reasons.
I come from Poland. My name is Joanna Kulpa. I'm a study student here. I strongly believe in the European project. I'm passionate about Europe. And I also want to follow my future career in Brussels.
And do you think that that's the case for most people here?
I think so. We actually, the mayor of Bruges has asked us, so who of you wants to work in Brussels? I think 90% raised their hands, so here we come.
My name is Bart Kastermans, and I'm from Belgium. I'm definitely here because I believe in the European integration project, and I want to be part of that. And in that sense, I'm also worried about the debt crisis. I think that we can overcome the problems if we go to further integration in some sense. We need to go further, but we might not be ready to go further.
Yeah, that's true. We are currently being educated in a way that we can then follow and help and contribute to the European project. And the fact that it's now being put at risk because of the economic problems, because of the debt crisis, of course it affects us. We actually had a course today about the internal market and the future of the internal market, and the professor started with how he's not happy with what is happening in Greece right now because he might lose a job, because this is something he specialised in.
Well, not all the teachers here, though, are panic-stricken. I'm off to see Wolfgang Kaiser. He teaches European history, and apparently he's been telling his students to keep a very cool head, because it's all about perspective.
I think when we look back over the period of 50 to 60 years of European integration, there have been many more such points in time when the European Union was in a major crisis. For example, in 1965, when the French under de Gaulle boycotted the Council of Ministers and nothing much happened at all in the European Economic Community at the time, and people thought it was going to fall apart and maybe a new organization would form with Britain instead of France in it. If you're a historian, then you've seen many crises before and you're looking at that professionally as I do, and then you've put this into perspective, and there's a lot of media hype as well about this.
Yeah, question two is about the regression of average.
I've come now into the garden. There are students huddled over their homework. And even those who are studying economics, like Federico from Italy, refuse to feel gloomy about the future.
We have a lot of faith.
Why do you have so much faith?
I don't think that just because, yeah, we are facing this big crisis, we should abandon the project.
Well, the European Union should try to foster the feeling of belonging to a European Union, something that is common to everybody.
Tell me your name.
I'm Nicola, and I just hope that in the longer run, also leaders from Germany, Netherlands, and Northern European countries in general will be able to recognize that they have taken very important benefits from the European integration, and therefore they will be willing to bear the burden from helping also southern European states.
This should be a moment for reflect and to start again with a new proposal and a new phase.
It is hard to feel bleak standing here in these pristine surroundings. And many of the students say that when they graduate, they hope that they will be able to play a role in helping to shape a stronger union. But if only Europe's decision makers were as positive as they are, that this can still be done. This is Vanessa Mock for Deutsche Welle Radio at the College of Europe in Bruges.
Now, the euro crisis has pushed the other hot topic of the year in Europe down the news agenda recently, the question of energy supply. But 6 months on from the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan, the shockwaves, if that's the right word, are still being felt across Europe. Germany has announced it will shut down all of its nuclear plants by 2022. Non-nuclear Austria wants to ban the import of nuclear-generated power from 2015 onwards. But in the Czech Republic, the talk is of maintaining and even expanding nuclear power, setting the country on a collision course with its neighbours. Rob Cameron has this report from Prague.
A promo film produced by the state-owned Czech power giant ČEZ to celebrate 25 years of the Dukovany nuclear power plant. Dukovany, about half an hour's drive from the country's second city, Brno, and the second newer plant at Temelín near the Austrian border, provide about 32% of Czech energy needs. Both were commissioned in the 1970s and both feature Soviet-designed pressurized water reactors combined with Western safety technology. Dukovany currently has four reactors online. ČEZ has permission to operate them until 2015, but says it's confident of winning a 10-year extension to run them at least until 2025, when they may be upgraded again. Temelín, meanwhile, has two reactors. The government will sign a $1 billion tender in 2013 to build two more. If you think this doesn't sound like a country that's having second thoughts about nuclear power in the wake of Fukushima, you'd be right. In fact, the town of Třebíč, which relies heavily on Dukovany for jobs, recently hosted an energy forum organised by the local Chamber of Commerce, a local university and an NGO representing 130 towns and villages in the vicinity of the plant. All say Dukovany plays a crucial role in the local economy and want the government to promise not only to upgrade Dukovany's four reactors, but even build a fifth one as well. Industry Minister Martin Kocourek spoke to reporters afterwards.
Dukovany will come into consideration after the two new reactors at Temelín have been built. In Temelín's case, we're talking about completion. In Dukovany's case, we're talking about expansion.
And opponents of nuclear power were further dismayed earlier in September when a Czech newspaper said it had seen what it claimed was a leaked copy of the country's long-term energy strategy, which counts on massive expansion of nuclear power, building up to 10 reactors by 2050 and increasing dependence on nuclear from the current 32% to an estimated 80%. So is there any opposition to the plans?
We have some 15 employees around here and plenty of volunteers.
This is Greenpeace climate campaigner Jan Rovensky showing me around the group's offices in Prague.
I think it's really crazy. And frankly to say, I really don't worry that this scenario could happen, because not because of the political will, but because of the money. They want to build these reactors in the next 40 or 50 years. And I'm quite sure that in 15 or approximately 20 years, there will be no economical interest in building nuclear reactors, because the renewable sources make the parity in the grid. So any reasonable investor will put money in the renewables because it will be cheaper and make quicker money than from the nuclear.
And an indication of Greenpeace's scepticism over the nuclear plans is that nuclear energy isn't even a campaign priority at the moment. The two big ones are coal and toxic pollutants. And then, of course, there's Germany.
Nach dem Kernkraftunfall in Fukushima.
That's Bundestag MP Josef Göppel, a member of Chancellor Angela Merkel's ruling CDU party. He's long been opposed to nuclear power and has warned the Czechs that with Germany abandoning nuclear altogether by 2022 and launching a massive effort into developing renewable energy to replace it, the Czech Republic may not have anywhere to export their nuclear-generated electricity.
We have, at this point, September 2011, 20.5% renewable energies, more as estimated. And we can estimate to 2020, 40% in Germany from renewable energies. Bavaria, 50%. And Bavaria is a neighbor of Czech Republic.
Mr. Göppel told me that his views on nuclear power had once left him very much on the fringes of Germany's conservative CDU. But since Fukushima, all that has changed. The overwhelming majority of Germans, he said, were now fully against nuclear power, and the country's politicians are devoted to finding alternative sources. One wonders what it would take for Czechs, who are largely pro-nuclear, to undergo a similar transformation. Rob Cameron, Deutsche Welle Radio, Prague. And I'm Rob Turner in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. The sound of the makam, a distinctive musical composition form unique to classical Arabic and Turkish music, is a predominant part of a thousand-year-old medical treatment, music therapy. Now, in one of Turkey's most modern hospitals, the Memorial in Istanbul, leading practitioners have been pioneering this as a complementary treatment to lower heart rates and blood pressure. Dorian Jones went to visit them and has this report.
It's not what you would probably expect to hear in an intensive care unit. The distinctive thousand-year-old twang of Sufi music wafts across the room instead of the usual bleep of heart monitors. Playing to the patients is one of the world's leading heart surgeons, Dr. Bingur Sommez.
We are the only team doing live music to the patients in intensive care. We are really, really scientifically successful. We just take a picture from the monitor, pressure is 170, pulse rate is 120. In 15 minutes, giving Sufi music, the pressure comes down to 125 with the same medication, without changing any medication. And the pulse rate comes down, and a patient feels more relaxed. We noticed even the nurses are speaking very quiet.
Sommez started the music therapy 5 years ago, but only after carefully researching the effectiveness of the music has he decided to go public with his methods. However, it's not just any type of music that has the healing powers. Sommez claims it's the special qualities of Sufi music which are most effective.
Sufi music is some sort of religious music, actually. It's some sort of meditation music, really. And if you play wrong music, it gives a side effect. It's like prescription. Some music has side effects. Some music have reverse effect. There are some makams. Makams is the type of the music. Some makams gives you happiness. Some music gives you agitation. So you must be a real expert. Dr. Erol always makes a conversation with the patient just to check his social level, intellectual level, and the health situation. And then he gives some music to them.
Dr. Erol Can playing a Sufi makam. He Sommez is an anaesthetist, and as the head surgeon freely admits, Can is a true musician of the team. In his spare time, he studies music and its history. He says what they are doing is nothing new, but rather resurrecting a tradition that dates back centuries.
This tradition here in Anatolia is maybe more than 1,000 years. There were shamans that were healing the patient with kind of drums and singing. And in the 15th century in the eastern Anatolia, there were shifahane, some kind of hospitals with live music, with music therapy, with sounds of falling water, with fountains, with some colored glasses, and the light of the sun is playing with these colors for cure the psychiatric patients. So this music has deep traditions.
So what do the patients think about it? Mustafa Koch is recovering from a major operation. He says the music helped him overcome the trauma, not only of the operation, but the loneliness of being in intensive care.
İnsanda orada bir duygulanıyor yani. Zaten tek başıyorsun yoğun bakımda.
You get emotional in this place. You're all alone in intensive care. Nobody can come and visit. So listening to it gives you a totally different feeling. Our professors play the flute, the pipe. It lifts your spirits. I really enjoyed the music there. You become one with your own feelings.
And many more patients also seem set to enjoy the sounds of Sufi music. Dr. Sommez, who enjoys international acclaim for his medical work, is now spreading the word to hospitals across the city and says he has history on his side.
I must confess, I'm one of the famous cardiac surgeons in this country. Whatever I do, all my colleagues criticize me. But in that subject, none of my colleagues criticized me. They definitely accepted what we were doing because nothing new. It has been done on this land more than 1,000 years. So if they say what I'm doing is wrong, that means people was doing wrong in 1,000 years.
So if Sommez's ideas catch on, intensive care patients in Istanbul and beyond will continue to be greeted by the beautiful and restful sounds of Sufi music for years to come. Dorian Jones, Deutsche Welle Radio, Istanbul.
This is Inside Europe, and I'm Rob Turner in Bonn. We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Rob Turner in Bonn. Coming up in the next half hour, meet the Italian who's gone on hunger strike until all the country's politicians have been sacked. Also on the programme, why foie gras is off the menu at the world's largest food fair, and Georgia toasts a bright future for its 8,000-year-old wine industry.
Georgia is the most wine-centric place on earth. Every major happening in life, as well as everyday eating, is totally laced with wine. You know, wine's everywhere.
Stay tuned for those stories and more. But first, when the news came, it was a shock to many, but a surprise to few. Vladimir Putin is set for another crack at the Russian presidency. At a recent congress of the ruling United Russia Party, Prime Minister Putin announced he would be swapping roles with current president Dmitry Medvedev, provided, of course, both are successful in their respective elections. Leaked US cables last year likened the pair to Batman and Robin, or Putin to Cardinal Richelieu, with Medvedev cast in the role of Louis XIII. Either way, the announcement at the party congress paved the way for Putin to potentially remain at the helm of Russian politics until 2024. Gerhard Kirkamp has more from Moscow.
More than 10,000 party members had gathered in the vast Luzhniki football stadium to listen to the expected landmark speeches by President Dmitry Medvedev and Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. The tight security measures during this Congress of the ruling party, United Russia, were a clear indication that this was a very special occasion indeed. Still, only a handful of those present knew about the announcements the two Russian leaders were about to make. Putin proposed that Medvedev would lead the party into the upcoming parliamentary election scheduled for December, and Medvedev in turn called upon the party members to support Putin's bid for the presidency in March next year. The ensuing standing ovation sounded like a sigh of relief after months of tension and speculation about whether or not Putin would decide to lead the country again. As Putin revealed, he and Medvedev had reached agreement on the move a long time ago.
I know that not only the members of United Russia, but all our supporters expect from the President of the Russian Federation and from the Prime Minister proposals about the structure of power after the elections. I want to inform you that we already, several years ago, agreed on what we would do in the future.
Apparently, that agreement was made in December 2007, when the chairman of United Russia and several other parties asked Putin to endorse the candidacy of Medvedev for the presidency in a carefully orchestrated television appearance. Putin agreed, naturally.
As far as the candidacy of Dmitry Medvedev is concerned, I can say that I have known him for more than 17 years. We have worked very closely together all those years, and I fully support this choice.
Medvedev was put forward to bridge the gap between Putin's expiring second and final consecutive term in office and a possible future presidential term. One of the first things Medvedev did when elected in March 2008 was to push through a change in the constitution, which prolonged the presidential term from 4 to 6 years. That move also very much appeared to be part of a well-considered plan aimed at returning Putin to the presidential hot seat at some point. If elected next March, Putin may stay at the helm until 2018 and for a possible second term after that until 2024. Both in Russia and abroad, the announcement at the party congress dealt a serious blow to the image of Medvedev as president. With some 7 months to go until the end of his term, his position has now been seriously weakened. That was clearly demonstrated 2 days later, when Medvedev more or less forced the finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, to resign. In front of the cameras, Medvedev lashed out at Kudrin for his criticism of significant planned increases in defense and pension spending. Kudrin, who had been the watchdog of the Russian state budget for 11 years, had indicated he was not prepared to sit in a government led by Medvedev. The president was furious at the snub.
Дисциплину и субординацию в правительстве никто не отменял.
No one has abolished discipline and subordination. If you do not agree with the course taken by the president, then there is only one way out, and you know which one. Resignation.
Kudrin replied he would consult the prime minister first, prompting an angry reply from Medvedev.
You can consult whoever you want, including the prime minister. But as long as I'm president, I shall take such decisions independently.
In the end, the finance minister barely concealed a smile and resigned soon after. As if to show he was still very much in charge, the next day Medvedev attended large-scale military exercises in the Ural Mountains, where he emphasized the need to increase defense spending. Russia, he said, was not a banana republic.
The Russian Federation is a huge country, a permanent member of the Security Council, with nuclear weapons. Therefore, spending on defense, on new arms, on salaries for military personnel, will remain a key priority. And those who do not agree with this may leave.
There may be difficult times ahead for Medvedev, and it remains to be seen for how long he will occupy the prime minister's seat after the elections. Observers have wondered why he and Putin had to announce their swapping chairs just now. The answer may be that the Russian economy is headed for hard times and that Putin, therefore, preferred to take over the wheel again as soon as possible. Capital flight is increasing rapidly and Russia may be seriously hit by another worldwide recession. In this respect, the departure of the respected finance minister is considered a bad omen by many investors.
Russia без Путина!
The opposition, in the meantime, expects to win support as a result of Putin's return to power, as Vladimir Ryzhkov, a leader of the unregistered People's Freedom Party, explained to his followers.
For us, for our party, this actually makes the situation easier, because millions of people who still harbored any illusions about President Medvedev and his empty liberal rhetoric will now join our camp.
Opposition groups believe that the number of people willing to take part in street demonstrations is likely to increase significantly in the coming months. Gerhard Kuhkamp, Deutsche Welle Radio, Moscow.
The potential return of Dominique Strauss-Kahn to French politics may not have provoked street demonstrations, but it has certainly been a controversial topic ever since allegations of sexual assault led to his demise as head of the International Monetary Fund. Now cleared of criminal charges, Strauss-Kahn is trying to get a civil action by the maid he was accused of raping thrown out of court as well. But it may not be enough to convince the French public to give him another chance. Elena Beardsley has this report from Paris.
After watching the Dominique Strauss-Kahn scandal unfold over the summer in New York, a record 13 million French viewers tuned in to hear the former socialist presidential hopeful give his version of the story in a live television interview earlier this month.
Ce qui s'est passé ne comprend ni violence.
What happened involved no aggression or violence, said Strauss-Kahn. But I admit it was more than inappropriate. It was a moral shortcoming on my part, towards my wife, my family, and the French people who placed their faith in me.
J'ai manqué mon rendez-vous avec les Français.
While his usual allies immediately lauded Strauss-Kahn's performance as courageous, on the streets of Paris, people were unimpressed. Many said they still didn't know what had happened in that hotel room, and that DSK, as he is known here, didn't even apologize. Far from it. During the interview, the first and only time he has spoken publicly since his arrest in New York last May, Strauss-Kahn hinted that his New York accuser was after his money, and he brandished the New York prosecutor's report several times, saying it cleared him. Only 4% of the French thought he came out of the interview looking better. Parisian Claude Marchand said the whole affair was scripted and phony.
It's a comedy. It's awful. It's indecent. The journalist, the man, all was prepared, very well prepared.
But media specialist Davina Frau Meg says Strauss-Kahn's interview, believable or not, did show that he was trying for a possible political comeback.
He presented himself as a head of state. He presented himself as not guilty of any of the charges. And he also showed that he was willing to wait and that he had learned a lesson. And I think that's what he's hoping for. He's hoping for to come slowly by the back door.
A recent poll shows that while 53% of the French don't want to see Strauss-Kahn back in French political life, 65% say France needs his advice on the economic crisis. The Socialist Party, where Strauss-Kahn was once the front-runner, was thrown into chaos by the New York scandal. Analysts say it has finally managed to get off the floor and stagger on without him. Six socialist candidates are running in a primary to face off against President Nicolas Sarkozy in the presidential election next May. They held their second televised debate this week. Strauss-Kahn's name never came up. The socialist frontrunner is now François Hollande, who is seen as competent yet mild-mannered to the point of dull, a striking contrast to Strauss-Kahn. Even if the American civil case against Strauss-Kahn is dropped, he's not in the clear. There is a criminal case against him in France. Two-year-old writer Tristan Bannon says Strauss-Kahn tried to rape her in 2003 when she came to interview him for her book. At a demonstration this week of feminists and Bannon's supporters, she told the crowd that France was too soft on sexual offenders.
Je me suis aperçue qu'il y avait des très, très, très gros problèmes dans la façon dont la France.
Bannon also said that if her criminal case against Strauss-Kahn does not go to trial, she too will pursue him in a civil court. Another rally took place this week in France. Teachers are angry about Sarkozy cutting public sector jobs. Most people who showed up to march in Paris were from the left, but nearly everyone, including Gérald Elkader, seemed embarrassed to talk about Strauss-Kahn.
This question is very difficult, you know, because Dominique Strauss-Kahn was my favorite for election, for many people as well, you know, for the teacher, Dominique Strauss-Kahn was the best. But with the problem, we know, you know, it's very difficult. It's not possible Dominique Strauss-Kahn come back. It's finished, we hope. It's finished for him.
Eleanor Beardsley, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
With their Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi mired in a range of scandals, Italians also seem unconvinced their political leaders are up to the task of dragging the country out of its economic dire straits. And one man in particular has reached the end of his tether. Gaetano Ferreri has been holding a hunger strike in front of the Italian Parliament since June. He and his supporters say they'll remain camped out there until not just Berlusconi, but all of Italy's parliamentarians have resigned. Megan Williams has the story from Rome.
Perched on a garden chair on the Roman cobblestones, 54-year-old Gaetano Ferreri speaks to a cluster of supporters sitting on the ground facing him. Lean and with a weather-beaten face, Ferreri has been here, just several hundred meters from the Italian parliament, on hunger strike for the past 3.5 months, sleeping in his nearby car at night, talking to supporters and passers-by by day. Ferreri is a former tax investigator turned activist and father of two young adults from Venice. He and his supporters are pushing for the dissolution of the current Italian parliament, followed by an electoral reform to allow people to vote directly for candidates rather than have parties choose them. They also want party funding and politicians' huge salaries cut.
Finanziamento ai partiti è cresciuto di 11 volte e mezza. Il finanziamento, diciamo, delle associazioni.
Public financing of political parties has grown to 11 times what it started out being, while costs of public services for Italians have doubled and families can no longer get by on the average income of 1,100 euros a month.
In contrast, politicians in Italy take home 12,000 euros a month, with another 2,500 for housing, free transportation, and a 3,000 euro monthly pension, making them the highest paid in Europe. But Ferreri says the problems go beyond bloated salaries.
It's not just that politicians are pillaging public coffers, but they're also now selling off our historic buildings and sites and companies to pay off the debt. It means there is no future for young people here.
Flyer distribution and sensibilize people opinion and to change Italy.
23-year-old Manuel Emilio is one of the young people who says his future is being sold. He's been blogging from the sit-in for the past 2 weeks, posting pictures of supporters dropping by and tracking the days Ferrieri has gone without food. He says there's a troubling disconnect between citizens and those representing them.
The politicians don't represent the people, and the people have angry and broken.
I'm living in a tent, basically, or in my car.
Alex Mar is a 35-year-old computer programmer from Turin. He feels so strongly that politicians have failed the electorate that he drove down to Rome to join the protest. He says support on street level has been strong, with hundreds signing a petition with the group's demands. But few Italians outside of Rome have heard much about their goals. Another result of politicians, he says, who have too much power and not enough accountability.
We have a national television in Italy, and it's controlled by the politician. It's controlled by Berlusconi. We all know that. And they censor a lot of things. For example, Polizia o Carabinieri telling the press to not film us. And media gave us very little visibility. Basically, just one television, which is called La Sette, gave us 30 seconds. 30 seconds in all these days.
Despite the lack of national coverage, Ferrieri says word is spreading and that he'll stay here without eating until his message is heard.
Ma siamo alla fine, perché se non si fa un controllo di quello che è il valore, ormai abbiamo...
Italy has reached the end of its rope. We see what's happening with Greece and Spain. If we're not able to get our public accounting in order and change what we spend money on, we'll find ourselves with even less money, less choice, and less freedom.
Ferrieri says it's not his generation he's on hunger strike for, but the future of his children and their generation. Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
And I'm Rob Turner in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Foie gras, the French delicacy that gets gourmets salivating and animal rights campaigners foaming at the mouth. The method of force-feeding geese to produce a rich-tasting liver pâté has long been the source of much controversy, so much so that Anuga, the world's largest food and beverage trade fair, has banned the product from this year's exhibition, which opens next week in Cologne, here in Germany. Around 6,500 exhibitors will be presenting their ideas, inspirations and innovations to around 150,000 visitors. Earlier, I asked Peter Grotus, the vice president of food at Cologne's trade fair, just why foie gras won't be on the menu this year.
Well, this is something that we look into details every 2 years when we set up the list of goods, and it's a proactive research that we do.
What kind of research? Was there an ethical reason behind the decision?
No, the problem is it's the only product on our list of goods that has a production ban in most of the European countries. But as there is the free trade in the EU, there is no point that we put it away out of the Anuga. So you can deal with it, you can show it, it's not a problem, but we don't need to make extra marketing for this product, which we do with our international trade fair Anuga.
And how did the foie gras producers react to the news?
Well, most of them can understand our point of view on that and will participate at Anuga. Some of them do not, and they do not exhibit at Anuga.
And what about the animal rights campaigners? Did you get reaction from them?
Yes, of course, we have a lot of reaction from them, but this is nothing that really makes our decision change in any way. It's a decision that we took already in 2009. And by the way, we do that with a lot of products that we have on our list that we look into deep details, how many people ask for this product, etc. like that.
For example?
It's for example, raw meat or pork products. How far do we have to go into detail? And there we found a good way to actually have only highlight products.
OK, and you mentioned there are a lot of products on the range. What are the highlights this year for you personally?
Well, for me personally, we do have some trends that we see at the Anuga. The major trend is actually free-from. Free-from products means fat-reduced or without fat, gluten-free, lactose-free, sugar-free, or free from conservatives or preservatives in the product. We also have a large participation in the organic and fair trade product range. New is also the part in ingredients. We do have stevia and derivatives that come from stevia that now push strongly into the market, which is a natural sweetener and cholesterol-free. And one major trend is also the convenience product. So we do have a lot of products that makes it easier to cook or to heat or to eat.
Because people have less time these days. Do you notice then that people are spending less time and money on complicated delicacies?
The subject actually is to be seen in two ways. On the one hand, you see a growth in the out-of-home market. So people go out eating and enjoy eating. On the other hand, the regular three-meal day is not there anymore. So you have a breakfast and you have, let's say, an evening meal. But for the production of regular foodstuffs, there is less time.
And I was talking there to Peter Grotus. Among the stalls at Anuga, you should be able to find wine from the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Back in 2006, Russia imposed an import ban on wine from Georgia, and the embargo wiped out roughly 80% of Georgian winemakers' export markets. 5 years later, Russia has hinted it's prepared to lift the ban as it moves closer to becoming a member of the World Trade Organization. That's good news for many Georgian winemakers, but it's also a worry for those who've spent the last 5 years developing new markets elsewhere. Our correspondent Marika Arden has more from the Georgian wine region of Kharkivia.
So we have to wait a few minutes because the gas is coming off. Right now we're fermenting inside, and when you're fermenting, if you breathe in too much of the gas, then we'll get lightheaded.
The American John Verdeman has come to check on his grapes, which were harvested just a couple of weeks ago. Behind a wooden door in a wine cellar at his vineyard, dozens of big clay jars are buried in the ground, covered by wooden lids. Inside, grapes are fermenting. At this early stage, the wine has an alcohol level of only 1%. This is a traditional Georgian way of winemaking here in Kakhetia, one of Georgia's main wine regions in the country's northeast. Wine has been made here for over 8,000 years. The clay jars in an oval shape, called quaveries, are one of the secrets of Georgian wine, says Verdeman.
Basically, the wine naturally filters itself through gravity. So everything heavy in the wine, all the impurities goes to the bottom. That's why the shape of the quaver is so important. And then we will siphon off the top the juice into a clean quaver to a neighboring quaver. And you keep moving it from quaver to quaver. And then the clean juice that's at the top, you keep moving.
35-year-old Verdeman, who wears his long blonde red hair in a ponytail, is actually a professional artist. He grew up in New Mexico and first arrived in Georgia in the late 90s. It was the country's traditional music and the landscape of the South Caucasus which attracted him, and he quickly learned that with over 500 different grape varieties, Georgia is the cradle of wine.
Georgia is the most wine-centric place on earth. Every major happening in life, as well as everyday eating, is totally laced with wine. You know, wine's everywhere.
These days, Verdeman speaks fluent Georgian, lives with his Georgian wife, and has dual citizenship. His foray into the wine business began in 2006 when a local winemaker drove by on his tractor as Verdeman painted a vineyard. The man came with a business proposition, and shortly afterwards, together with another American and a Swedish investor, they founded the wine company Pheasant Tears, named after a legend that a certain wine can make pheasants cry. To Verdeman, local traditions, organic production, and the variety of grapes are the key to the success of Georgian wines worldwide.
There's something special about this place. The wind here, the amount of precipitation, the amount of sunlight, the soil composition, the rocks that are here. And if you're going to overly process your wine, if you're going to use foreign yeast that aren't native to here, It's stripping the face of the wine away.
A 20-minute drive away from the vineyard is the little town of Signaghi. That's where Vurdemann is heading now. Signaghi has cobbled streets and is set against spectacular mountain scenery. The town was recently overhauled with government money to attract more international tourists to the wine region. It's here that Vurdemann and his partners aim to sell their bottles to visitors for 15 to 35 euros each. In Signaghi, they are running a wine bar that has a little restaurant. Gila Patalishvili, the local winemaker who first proposed the business idea to Vurdemann, is already waiting there. Patalishvili approached Vurdemann in 2006, just after Russia banned Georgian wine imports after a spying scandal. The dispute saw Russia, which imported more than 80% of the wine produced in Georgia in 2005, suddenly disappear as a customer, leaving a surplus of 40 million bottles on the market. That was a real shock, remembers Patalishvili.
It was a time when Georgian wine was made with very little artistry or care. The wine was strictly a source of material revenue. One tried to squeeze as many bottles as possible out of a vineyard. It was very lucrative, but we weren't very proud about the quality of the wine.
Gila Patalishvili is, however, very proud of the wine he produces now with Vurdemann, even if it is on a small scale. The 40,000 bottles they make annually are exported to 9 countries, mainly to Hong Kong, the UK, Sweden and the USA. The company hopes to expand production to 80,000 bottles a year soon.
Of course, it's sad to have something extremely special which so few people know about. But with the help of the internet and new ways of communicating, the world's becoming very small. In the past, it would have taken much longer to inform the world about our traditions.
Russia recently indicated it is ready to discuss lifting its ban for Georgian wine. Experts believe this is connected to Moscow's bid to become a member of the World Trade Organization, an application that Georgia, which is already a member, could veto. While many Georgian winemakers would welcome the end of Russian restrictions, John Vurdemann believes it was good that the industry was forced in previous years to look beyond Russia for potential buyers and to focus on quality instead of quantity.
So then we have to ask ourselves the question, well, what happens now if the market's opened? Frankly, a lot of us are afraid. We feel like although a transformation started, that it needs a little bit more time, and that it might be actually best for the wine industry, in terms of the quality of the wines, to keep it closed for another year or two.
It seems that Georgian President Mikhail Zakashvili also feels torn. On the one hand, his crisis-ridden country could certainly use the Russian wine market to get more cash into the economy. On the other, he's reluctant to see the wine industry rely so heavily on a single market, something he stressed while touring the country's wine region at the beginning of September. Saakashvili knows, and all Georgians know, that Russia's appetite for Georgian wine is big, but it could very well be spoiled again quite soon, depending on political flavors. Mareike Aden, Deutsche Welle Radio, Cahitia.
And that just about wraps up today's show. If you want to drop us a line, we're always very happy to hear your thoughts. Our email address is europe@dw-world.de. Or you can write the old-fashioned way to Inside Europe, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. Be sure to tune in again next week. But for now, on behalf of producer Neil King and sound engineer Michael Springer, thanks for listening. And it's goodbye from me, Rob Turner. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.